This episode is provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenis, based on the most relevant LinkedIn posts about ICT and tech insights from CW23 and 24. Frenis supports ICT enterprises in the form of delivering precise ICT market and pricing intelligence that analysts, subscriptions, and existing databases cannot provide. You can find more info in the description.
Yeah, and we have a really fantastic deep dive lined up for you today.
We absolutely do. I mean, if you are listening to this, you're probably dealing with some level of network architecture or enterprise data right now.
Right.
And we really want to set the stage here. We are cutting through all the surface level noise today to bring you the top ICT and tech trends that we've curated directly from LinkedIn across calendar weeks 23 and 24 of 2026.
Exactly, because there's just so much hype out there. You know, but we want to look at the raw mechanics of where the industry is actually heading.
Yeah, the real stuff. So here is the roadmap for today. We're going to break this down into four main clusters. First, we're looking at AI agents and the actual data they run on,
which is a huge bottleneck right now.
Oh, absolutely. Then we're moving into the physical reality of AI. So we're talking massive infrastructure and edge compute realities.
And then, of course, when you push everything to the edge, you have to talk about cybersecurity in this new hyper fast era.
Terrifying stuff there.
Yeah.
And finally, we will wrap up with quantum readiness and why digital sovereignty has suddenly become a massive boardroom priority.
I can't wait. Let's just jump right into that first theme because, like we said, everyone on your feed is talking about AI.
For sure. It's inescapable.
But Sandra Veller had this post that really stood out. She pointed out this fundamental disconnect. She basically said that most enterprises out there right now, they don't actually have an AI problem.
Wait, really? What do they have then?
They have a clean data and undocumented process problem.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Right. It's like the ultimate reality check. You see these companies, they're buying up these massive enterprise licenses for advanced language models, but their internal data is just, well, it's a disaster.
So the information is totally siloed. Permissions are probably all over the place.
Exactly. And the processes are entirely undocumented. So if you just slap a highly advanced algorithmic engine on top of that mess,
it doesn't actually fix anything.
No. It just executes your operational chaos, but at an unprecedented scale.
It's so funny you say that because, I mean, giving an autonomous AI access to undocumented corporate data, it's not even like adding a jet engine to a horse-drawn buggy.
Yeah.
It's like putting a high-speed automated drill in a pitch-black room.
Oh, man. That is a great analogy.
You know, it's going to find a structural pipe in the wall and it's going to burst it way faster than a human ever could. Just totally automated mistakes.
Yeah, you're just making faster mistakes. And that actually sets up a much larger issue that Dr. Inshan Majan brought up in his post.
Okay, what was his take?
Well, he's looking at the evolution of these tools. We're crossing this critical threshold right now where AI is moving from just being a helpful assistant, you know, like a chatbot drafting an email.
Right, the passive stuff.
Yeah, passive, but now it's becoming an autonomous agent.
Meaning it actually executes actions completely on its own.
Exactly. So we're talking about agents that can autonomously move corporate funds or grant and revoke system access. They can even push unreviewed code directly into production.
That is terrifying.
It is. And Dr. Majan asks this critical question. When that agent inevitably makes a mistake, who actually answers for it?
Oh, the liability aspect.
Yeah. Like, if an autonomous system incorrectly revokes access to your entire customer database during peak hours, whose name goes on that incident report?
I mean, I would assume it's the IT director, right? Yeah. Or whoever actually deployed the agent.
You'd think so, but Majan is arguing that we have to define these accountability operating models before the fallout happens, not during the postmortem when everyone is pointing fingers.
But let me push back on this for a second, because if the underlying data structure is as broken as Sandra Veller said, and the liability of autonomous action is this high, shouldn't companies just hit the brakes?
You'd think that would be the logical move.
Right. Why even risk it right now?
Well, Stefan Schäble actually addressed this exact dilemma with some insights from the Tech 2026 conference. And he argues that hitting the brakes is actually an even bigger strategic risk.
Really? Because the competition is moving too fast.
Exactly. You can't just pause your entire deployment because your data house isn't perfectly clean. Your competitors definitely aren't waiting around for you.
So what's the solution then? If you can't stop, but going too fast is dangerous.
Schaible says it comes down to boardroom-level strategic decisions about data partitioning.
Okay, so deciding what the AI is actually allowed to see.
Yeah, you have to draw hard borders. Leadership has to define exactly what proprietary data is safe to feed into the models to get that efficiency boost, and what core IP absolutely has to stay locked in the vault to protect the company.
That makes a lot of sense.
And he also emphasized that you need genuine buy-in from the humans who are actually using these systems. Because if your engineering team or your finance team doesn't trust the AI agents, or they feel threatened by them, the whole deployment just stalls out anyway.
It always comes back to the people, doesn't it?
It really does.
But, you know, we're talking about these agents running millions of automated tasks, but that intelligence isn't just floating in the ether.
Oh, no, definitely not.
It is boiling water in a data center somewhere. And this is a great transition to our second theme, the physical infrastructure.
I love this topic.
Because Henri Nakarundi had this fascinating point that totally shifts the economic perspective here.
What did he say?
He argues that as these AI models become commodities, you know, as digital intelligence just becomes abundant and cheap, the real trillion-dollar value is shifting down the stack.
Down to the physical hardware.
Exactly. It's moving to everything that intelligence physically depends on. So we're talking energy grids, specialized chips, and the actual concrete and steel of the data centers.
And the engineering data completely backs up Henri's thesis. Ong Tun shared some hard numbers on what modern infrastructure actually requires. And honestly, the scale is just difficult to even comprehend.
Lay it on me. How big are we talking?
Well, modern high-density AI server racks are now pushing power density past 100 to 300 kilowatts per single rack.
Wait. Okay, let's just pause on that number for the IT professionals listening. A traditional enterprise server rack runs at what, like 5 to 15 kilowatts?
Often less than 10.
Wow. So 300.
Yeah. You are basically looking at condensing the power draw of an entire small neighborhood into the physical footprint of a kitchen refrigerator.
That is insane. The heat coming off that must be unbelievable.
It is. The physical heat generated by 300 kilowatts of concentrated compute means that traditional air cooling simply hits a physical wall.
You literally can't blow enough cold air fast enough.
No. You can't blow chilled air through a chassis fast enough to stop the silicon from just completely melting down. Tenz points out that cooling is no longer just a supporting facility system.
It's the main event.
Exactly. Thermal management is dictating the entire architecture of the data center now. You have to engineer direct-to-chip liquid cooling or even those full immersion systems right from day one.
Which means retrofitting old data centers for AI is practically impossible.
Pretty much, yeah.
You basically have to build them from scratch. And because of these intense constraints on the ground, you know, trying to find land, finding the water for cooling, getting enough power from the grid. Some engineers are literally looking up.
Oh, you mean orbital compute?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ken Kwong posted about this. When people hear space data center, I think they immediately picture this giant sci-fi floating Pentagon in space.
Right, like the Death Star, but for servers.
Exactly. But Kwong explains that the future of space compute is actually these distributed Starlink-style satellite racks.
It sounds so exotic, but honestly, the mechanics make a lot of sense when you dig into it.
Really? I mean, the launch costs alone.
Sure, launch costs are a factor, but by placing standardized modular compute racks in low Earth orbit, you bypass all terrestrial real estate issues. And the cooling challenge becomes totally different in the vacuum of space.
Oh, because it's freezing.
Well, depending on how you manage the solar radiation, yeah, ambient cooling is a completely different engineering game up there. But more importantly, it takes edge computing to its absolute extreme limit.
Just bypassing the entire terrestrial network.
Yeah, it minimizes latency for global remote operations anywhere on the planet.
I don't know. I'm still not entirely convinced the launch costs justify it quite yet.
Mm-hmm.
But the modular approach Kwong is talking about isn't just for space.
That's true.
Sudipta Bhattacharya and Ibrahim Kisioglu kind of synthesized a similar trend happening right here on the ground. They're arguing that the era of the massive, centralized, monolithic, hyperscale data center is actually ending.
And it has to end, simply due to material and grid limits. I mean, you just cannot find enough concentrated gigawatts of power on the terrestrial grid to keep building these massive brute force campuses indefinitely.
So what's the alternative? breaking them apart.
Yeah, Bhattacharya and Kisyoglu see the physical infrastructure evolving into a highly integrated, distributed ecosystem. You build specialized tiers.
Okay, what does that look like?
Well, you'll still have hyperscale AI campuses, but they will be dedicated purely to heavy asynchronous model training. And they'll be built wherever raw power, like a dedicated nuclear plant or geothermal, is available.
Okay, so way out in the middle of nowhere.
Right. But those training hubs will be deeply networked to a massive web of smaller modular edge facilities. And those will be located super close to the actual users, factories, and autonomous vehicles to handle all the real-time inference.
Ah, so spreading out the real-time load. But hold on. If you distribute your physical infrastructure to thousands of these extreme edge locations, and earlier we were talking about handing the operational keys over to autonomous AI agents.
Yep. I know where you're going with this.
You are blowing your attack surface completely wide open.
Absolutely wide open.
Which brings us perfectly to our third cluster.
Ugh.
The terrifying reality of cybersecurity in this hyper-fast era.
And speed really is the fundamental change here. Matthew Rosenquist shared this wild update regarding frontier AI models, specifically pointing to a model called Mythos.
Okay, what did he find?
He notes that AI is collapsing the vulnerability patch window. Historically, you know, when a zero day was discovered, security teams had days, maybe even weeks, to test and deploy a patch before adversaries could really weaponize it at scale.
Right, there was a human bottleneck.
Exactly, but now that window is shrinking down to literally minutes.
Minutes. Imagine a piece of malware that breaches your firewall and then dynamically rewrites its own exploit code in the 3 minutes it takes your security team to go grab a cup of coffee.
It's terrifying because the AI can ingest the vulnerability disclosure, write the exploit code, and deploy it across a network faster than a human analyst can even triage the very first alert.
The adversary is fully automated. They don't sleep.
Right. They process code at machine speed. But we also have to balance this high-tech anxiety with a grounded reality check.
Okay, please give me some good news.
Well, Jane Franklin pointed out this deeply frustrating truth about enterprise security. Despite all the industry panic over nation-state threats and AI zero days, the vast majority of debilitating breaches still happen for really dumb reasons.
Because organizations just ignore the absolute basics.
Yes. She says it's usually weak passwords or legacy systems that haven't been patched in a year, or, you know, access rights that haven't been reviewed since an employee changed departments like 3 years ago.
So we're essentially so distracted looking up at the sky for these Terminator AI threats that we're just forgetting to lock the digital front door.
Exactly. And the AI doesn't need to invent a brilliant new exploit if it can just turn the doorknob on a basic administrative portal that you left exposed to the public internet a million times a second.
Which means your defense strategy has to totally shift. You can't just build higher walls. You have to assume the walls are already breached.
Marcel Velika's insights completely confirm this. He emphasizes that cyber resilience matters significantly more than pure prevention right now. You just simply cannot prevent every single AI speed attack.
So it's about bouncing back.
Yeah. Velika argues that the organizations that actually survive these incidents are the ones that practice their response routines relentlessly, like before the crisis ever hits.
They engineer systems to isolate compromised nodes automatically.
Right. It's all about minimizing the blast radius and the recovery time instead of pretending you can block everything.
Now, if you're listening to this and you manage a regional IT team, you might be thinking, you know, I don't have the budget of a hyperscaler to fight these automated threats.
Which is a very fair point.
It is. But Mohammed Syed posted some highly actionable advice for exactly this scenario, particularly targeting tech professionals in regions like APAC or the Middle East.
I saw that post. His core argument is so smart. He says you don't actually need a massive Silicon Valley budget to capitalize on this security gap.
No, not at all. Because his roadmap leverages the exact same tools the adversaries are using. He lays out this targeted 6 to 8 week sequence.
Right. He advises professionals to start by using free cloud tiers and open source AI tools to build their own defensive agents, like get hands-on with the mechanics of how these models interact with network logs.
But the real kicker in his strategy isn't just learning the tech. It's mapping those AI capabilities directly to local governance frameworks.
And that is the crucial differentiator. He suggests taking those automated defensive routines and mapping them to frameworks like NIST or ISO, specifically tailoring them to local regulated industries in your specific region.
So if you can automate compliance auditing for a regional bank in the Middle East using free open source AI, you suddenly become the regional AI security go-to person.
Exactly. Because the technology itself is global, but compliance and liability, that is always hyperlocal.
And mastering that intersection is how you make yourself completely invaluable without needing a $10 million security budget.
It's brilliant.
It really is. So let's shift gears again. We talked about AI speeding up current threats, but let's talk about a technology that threatens to just break the locks entirely.
Quantum.
Yes, our final cluster. Quantum readiness and digital sovereignty. For a long time, quantum computing felt like just a purely academic exercise, right?
Yeah, like cool physics, but not a real network architect problem.
Exactly. But Dr. Aaron C. Kemp highlighted this massive shift from the research lab to hard industrial reality.
The numbers he shared really indicate a tipping point. The U.S. government and IBM have committed over $12 billion specifically to quantum manufacturing and fault-tolerant computing.
And they are targeting a 2029 timeline, right?
Yeah, 2029. It's right around the corner.
Wait, real quick, for those who might not know, what does fault-tolerant actually mean in this context? Because quantum states are notoriously fragile.
They are incredibly unstable. Like, the slightest temperature change or a little bit of electromagnetic interference causes the quantum bits, the qubits, to lose their state.
Which introduces massive calculation errors.
Right. So fault-tolerant computing means engineering systems that can automatically correct those errors in real time, which allows the machine to actually run complex algorithms reliably.
That makes sense. But the most critical detail in Kemp's post isn't even the tech itself. It's the financial structure of the deal.
Yeah, the government is taking equity stakes in these ventures.
They aren't just handing out university research grants anymore. They are literally buying into the supply chain.
Which proves this is now an industrial reality. When the government takes an equity position, they are signaling that the foundational cryptographic standards, the stuff that protects everything from your banking to military communications, are officially on a ticking clock.
And that reality fundamentally changes corporate strategy. Allison King and Lawrence Belton both posted about this, emphasizing that quantum readiness is no longer just a problem for the CSO.
No, it has escalated. It is now a CFO's problem.
Because migrating away from our current encryption to post-quantum cryptography requires serious budget allocation.
It is not just a simple software update you run over the weekend. Belton and King point out that you have to fund deep asset discovery first.
What does deep asset discovery actually entail, though? Are they just running a network scan?
No, it is far more complex than a scan. We are talking about hunting down cryptographic libraries that are hard-coded into legacy applications from, like, 15 years ago.
Oh, wow. The stuff everyone forgot about.
Exactly. You have to find every single instance where vulnerable encryption is used across your entire enterprise architecture. And then you have to fund the modernization of those systems without breaking current production.
Good luck with that.
Right. If the CFO isn't involved in funding that discovery phase right now, the organization is going to be caught completely flat-footed when the current standards are officially deprecated.
It really is a massive infrastructure overhaul, but it's just disguised as a security update.
Absolutely.
And bringing this conversation back to Europe for a minute, the insights curated from leaders at the Tech 2026 conference were incredibly sharp regarding the geopolitical side of this infrastructure.
Yeah, Tim Höttges was very blunt on stage.
What did he say?
He stated that Germany needs an AI gigafactory because, in his exact words, scale eats sovereignty for breakfast.
Scale eats sovereignty for breakfast. That is such a great quote.
It perfectly captures the tension in Europe right now. He's highlighting this harsh truth. You simply cannot legislate digital sovereignty if you don't actually own the underlying compute and the physical infrastructure.
Right. If all your critical enterprise data and citizen services are just sitting on foreign-owned hyperscale servers, your sovereignty is just an illusion on paper.
You are entirely dependent on their terms of service, their security protocols, and their national jurisdictions. To have true sovereignty, you need the physical hardware on your own soil, operating under your own legal frameworks.
And Iris Rothbauer captured the solution to this perfectly in her notes from the conference. She specifically referenced the opening by Lisa Pacosta from Estonia and Carsten Weilberger from Germany.
Right, they signed that new innovation partnership.
Yeah, and it proves that digital sovereignty isn't just an abstract political ambition anymore. It's a practical execution challenge.
It requires cross-border trusted infrastructure. I mean, Estonia has been a huge pioneer in digital government services for years, but they need the industrial scale that Germany can provide.
And Weilberger, Infocosys' partnership really shows that building this sovereign capability requires speed and deep integration.
You have to actually build the data centers. You have to train the sovereign AI models on local languages and local laws, and you have to deploy the quantum-resistant networks together.
You can't just talk about it in Parliament. You have to go pour the concrete and rack the servers.
Exactly.
Which really brings all the clusters we've discussed today full circle, doesn't it?
It really does. We are entering this era where the physical infrastructure is distributed to the extreme edge, the software agents are totally autonomous, the cyber attacks are basically instantaneous, and the underlying cryptography is in a race against quantum decryption.
It's just a massive, complex web of dependencies. But I think understanding how the physical power constraints limit the AI models and how those models in turn rewrite the rules of cybersecurity, that is the shortcut to being truly well-informed in this industry right now.
Absolutely. And if you are a practitioner trying to build resilient systems in this kind of environment, you have to assume that the infrastructure you deploy today will be operating under completely different stress parameters in just a few years.
For sure.
But I do want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, kind of connecting those autonomous agents back to the cyber threats we discussed.
Okay, let's hear it.
If AI is collapsing attack windows from weeks down to literally minutes, and quantum computing threatens the very mathematical foundations of our cryptography, our only logical choice is to fully automate our cyber defenses, right?
Right. We have to fight machines with machines.
Exactly. But as we hand over the keys to autonomous AI agents to protect our most critical infrastructure, letting them make split-second decisions to quarantine networks or revoke access, how do we ensure we don't accidentally automate our own permanent lockout from these systems when a defensive machine inevitably misinterprets a signal?
That is a terrifying but very real question to end on. If you enjoyed this episode, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions on cloud, defense tech, digital products and services, artificial intelligence, sustainability and green ICT, defense tech, and health tech.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the real mechanics driving the industry.
Keep questioning the consensus, map your models to your local frameworks, and don't forget to subscribe.